For Gallup, I'm Muhammad Yunus, and this is the Gallup Podcast. In this episode, we discuss the World Risk Poll as we take a look at the first ever global study of how citizens perceive risk and experience worry in their own daily lives. Sarah Cumbers is Director of Evidence and Insight at Lloyd's Register Foundation. Richard Clegg is Managing Director at Lloyd's Register Foundation. Folks, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Muhammad.
Thank you.
Before we get into the details, maybe Sarah, as a fellow researcher, maybe I should ask you, how expansive is this World Risk Poll? How many countries does it span?
Thanks, Muhammad. This is a world first in terms of the number of countries that we've covered, asking people about their perceptions and experiences of risk. 142 countries and 150,000 interviews in those countries, reaching parts of the world that we just don't have this kind of data on at the moment.
Which is absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that really struck me as I looked through the findings is just the different cultural context, economic context, political context that people live in across the world, and how this concept of risk is really universal but plays out so differently. Richard, let me ask you, why did Lloyd's Register Foundation want to measure risk across the world? How does it tie into kind of your mission as an organization originally?
No, thank you, Muhammad. You're absolutely right. This is at the core of our mission. We have a charitable purpose, which is to make the world a safer place, essentially. To us, when we talk about safety, it's about the critical infrastructure that societies around the world rely on, things like where we get our energy from, our water, our food, our transportation, communication systems, all of that sort of critical infrastructure. If we're here to make the world a safer place, when we achieve that, if we achieve that, in whose eyes is the world safer? And it's for society, because that's who we serve. We're a charity, we serve society or societies around the world. And so if we want to make the world safer, it's not only that it has to be physically safer, people have to feel and believe that it's safer as well. And ... that takes it into a space where we've got no data, we've got no understanding, we've got no insight into what people think and feel about risk in their everyday lives. And so that's why we commissioned this survey. We're on a journey to make the world safer. And like any journey, we need to know where we're starting from. And this is collects that data for us.
And that's what is, of course, to me as somebody who works at Gallup and focuses on public opinion, is so fascinating about this study, because assessments of risk obviously are not new to the world of finance, economics, state planning, right? There are a lot of ways to assess risk, whether it's political or otherwise, in various situations. But this is really about asking individual citizens really about what they know most about their local reality, because in the end, those assessments are really just a projection on situations from a faraway office. You know, we do the best as we can as analysts, but you really don't know what's happening until you speak to the people on the ground. Sarah, what were some of the findings that kind of caught your eye as a researcher in this first wave of study?
Yeah, so we covered a whole range of areas, as you say, asking the people what they felt in terms of what was going to cause them harm and also what their experience was of those particular risks. And we asked questions across a whole range of areas, including how safe people felt back in 2019 when the poll was conducted compared to 5 years previous to that. We asked an open-ended question about people's perceived biggest perceived risk to safety in their daily life. And we asked about perceptions and experience of risk at work, safety of food, and perceptions of risk from technology and the internet and climate change. Of risks. And we uncovered some really intriguing findings across each of these specific areas. But for me, it was some of the general insights that we've got that then tied together as strands of insight across all of these areas that were the most exciting findings for the World Risk Poll. And so we know, for example, that generally people's individual circumstances are a better predictor of how they feel about particular risks than are their experiences. And that's important because it means that we can look at different demographic groups and these differences here to design specific interventions to help reduce risk or influence people's risk perception. And just as an example, we found that age impacted on risk perceptions around the internet. So the older generation are more aware of the risk of fraud, the younger generation is cyberbullying.
And that's what was really wonderful about the study, is that you really kind of take a modern approach to risk, right? It's not like traditional slip and fall, do you live in a dangerous environment? It's also including your activity online. It's including perceptions of the impact of the changing climate around us. It also includes not just access to food and water, but the quality of that food and water, the safety of it, if you will. Richard, what were some of the findings that struck you the most? Obviously, you're somebody that's been focused on this topic your whole career. This was the first opportunity to really see from the voice of people across the world what risks they identified. What stood out to you in this wave of study?
I think one of the striking findings for me has been the correlation between people suffering physical risk, as we would traditionally understand it, and the connection with mental health. And for the first time, there's data coming out of the World Risk Poll that shows that if you've experienced a physical injury, particularly at work, then you are twice as likely for that to have mental health or mental well-being consequences. So that correlation between physical and mental health is, I think, a really big insight. And I think as we start to collect more data, we're going to get more insight into this, and it's going to become a growing theme for the foundation. I think also it's just been the sheer magnitude of some of these numbers, that 19% of the world's population, that's over a billion people, have said that they've experienced, you know, serious injury at work. And also, when we just have a look at the food as well, some of the size of some of these numbers shows us the scale of the problem, that again, about a billion people in the world, 17% of those surveyed said that they have suffered serious harm from the food that they've eaten. So it just begins to show us the size of these risks, but where also this risk is coming from.
And it's amazing, again, how just thinking about development, human development, and the UN's efforts to track SDGs, this work really comes kind of like at a horizontal angle, where it touches on so many of those critical life dimensions, and highlights how risk really plays out in safety, in one's own personal safety, their access to clean air and water, their access to a job that doesn't result in injuring them. Sarah, what are you hoping to contribute to sort of these larger research efforts globally to understand how the world is changing from place to place? Where does the World Risk Poll kind of plug in there?
It plugs in a variety of different ways. It plugs in to academia, and we've got a lot of academics who have an interest in the World Risk Poll who contributed to the formulation of the questions in the first place, and are also working with us, because this is a multi-year effort. We're going back into the field with Gallup in 2021, so those academics are also supporting the evolution, the iteration of those questions through the cognitive testing process for 2021. And they're all really excited about the data, which I should also add is in the public domain. We felt that it was really, really important because we want to make a significant impact with this data, that it's freely available. And so those academics now have the access to that data. And so that's going to plug into their studies. The policy community and governments and NGOs who are all wanting to take action on the variety of risks that we polled about. And so they're all going to be using the data in different ways. And we've already got three UN agencies who are interested in the data. So the International Labour Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, and also Disaster Risk Reduction, who we're talking to about 2021. And they've all got different ideas about how the data can be used. I mean, the ILO, for example, are really excited about the poll results being the voice of the people, to complement the official statistics that they have, but in quite a lot of the countries that we polled in are incomplete.
Absolutely.
Just not available. And then there's a third way in which we can influence action as well, which is actually by working with the communities who bear these risks. And we've been working with an organisation called Sense About Science in the UK, who are in touch with a range of leaders locally who are working with individuals who face risks in their daily lives, and working with them to improve their understanding about risk and to empower them to take action so that their lives are safer, and also so that they feel safer. So we've got those three tiers through which we're influencing action.
And I can't stress, just as somebody who spends a lot of time around data, the public access to the data is really a huge public service. It's available, of course, on the World Risk Polls website. It's also available on the Gallup website. And I'll tell you, it's one of the most downloaded or visited sites on all of our web spaces, because there's just so much demand and really so many uses for this kind of information being available to the public. Richard, I want to ask you about policymakers and leaders. We've talked a lot about academics and the United Nations and the development world. What about leaders at large, people running countries, running companies? Why is this research, why are these data critical for them?
Well, this for the very first time gives 98% of the world's population a voice. It's a voice that's never been heard before. It's about what their experiences are and what their beliefs are around risk and safety and harm in their everyday lives. Sarah said that this is a call to action. It's more than just an interesting statistical poll. We now want to use this data to target interventions that are actually going to make a difference in the world, that are going to improve people's experiences and exposure to harm. And those interventions are going to have to be made by politicians, regulators, people that own or deliver critical infrastructure. And so it's a call to action. And the cleverness really now is how we can turn all this evidence and insight from this poll into practicality. And we need to work with these partners now, these impact partners, to turn this into a benefit for society.
So there are two variables I think of that the world is facing now. One is as old as the world is, and the other one is this pandemic, but gender and COVID. Let's start with gender. What were some of the disparities or data gaps that we saw across gender lines on these metrics?
Yes, that's a really, really interesting focus point for the analysis that we undertook with the 2019 poll. We asked people whether they felt safer, as safe or less safe when the poll was conducted in 2019 than 5 years previously. And in general, it's a positive story. 36% of respondents told us that they felt safer, the same number as safe, and 25%, so a quarter of the population, felt less safe. But actually, if you break down those findings by gender, you find that women were more likely to feel less safe than men, and particularly women in high-income economies. So 32% of women living in high-income economies felt less safe in 2019 than 5 years previously, compared to 23% of men, so 9% gap there. So that then begs the question, why? And there's a whole rich analysis in the report here. You know, we don't have the capacity at this stage to go down into, you know, country by country analysis. But in general, if people had confidence in their institutions, like the local police, for example, they were more likely to feel safe. And there was a correlation between people's perceptions of risk from crime and violence with that response to whether they felt less safe or not. But this is one of the areas that I'd really like to see some more research going into, so that we really understand why women feel less safe.
Richard, any reflections on the gender disparities you saw in the data?
Yeah, the data also showed that men, and particularly young men, are more likely to be seriously harmed at work. And this probably reflects the fact that what the poll also showed us is those occupations that present the greatest risk in fishing and agriculture and construction, which is probably those sorts of occupations are the ones that males and particularly young men are employed in. So we can see that as well coming through the data.
Mohammed, if I may, one of the really striking findings for me in the poll was the number of people worldwide who had experienced or were worried about violence and harassment in the workplace. Absolutely staggering figures. So up to 50% of people in some countries experience violence and harassment in the workplace. And again, we see a gender gap in some of these countries. So in the top countries for experience, so Zambia, for example, about the same numbers of women and men experiencing violence and harassment in the workplace. So a clear need for action for all workers worldwide. But in some high-income countries in particular, there was a particular issue for women. So you look at the results for Australia, 39% of Australian female workers that experience violence and harassment.
Wow.
Compared to 24% of men. So nearly twice as many women who'd experienced that issue at work. And that's, again, another area. I know that there's a convention, an ILO convention on violence and harassment in the workplace, and we'll be looking to do some more work here, really, to see how we can influence action on this issue.
Yeah, and I'd just like to build on that a little bit, because we were talking a moment ago about this being a call to action, that we need to work with stakeholders and with impact partners to try and turn this wealth of data into some sort of practicality. And Sarah's mentioned the ILO, and this is one of the early outputs that is beginning to emerge, you know, the opportunity for us armed with this data to work in tandem with the ILO to start to see if we can understand and improve this this situation of harassment and physical violence in the workforce. And it's also really quite surprising for me that this not only exists, but it exists in the countries that the World Risk Poll is identifying for us. And Sarah mentioned, you know, the figures in Australia. You know, 42% of women in Finland feel the same or have experienced the same. 38% in France, 32% in Sweden. You know, these are developed countries, and it's not a problem or an issue that I thought before seeing this data would have had at that level of profile in those sorts of countries.
I was just going to make that point. It is fascinating to see one's own, even as a researcher, right, one's own preconceived notions being shattered by kind of what you would expect to see from the data and the very clear challenges that still face us.
And one, Mohammed, sorry, ahead, just on that point. So that, just to confirm, so those figures that Richard has quoted there are the perception figures. So we also can see through the poll that actually people are fearful of this risk in the workplace. That, you know, in Finland, for example, 42% of women perceiving there to be a risk from violence and harassment in the workplace. In many countries, actually, the perception of fear from violence and harassment runs ahead of experience, which also means that people are fearful of something, of a risk that may not materialise, and yet they're modifying their behaviour at work. You know, it's going to have an impact on their mental well-being. So, again, need to do something about this.
And that's what I want to talk to you both a little bit more about that, because it is fascinating how you also measured not only people's perceptions of risk, but the actual likelihood they face certain risk-prone situations, right? So I may be afraid of getting hit by a bus, but I actually live in, you know, somewhere where that's very unlikely to happen, as a very bad example. Talk to us about how you measured that and what you found.
Yeah, that's not such a bad example to use, actually, Mohammed, because when we ask the top of the mind question, what's the greatest source of risk to safety in your daily life? The most common response that we got back was harm from road traffic. And we got that within high income and in low income countries. But interestingly enough, the statistics show that you're far less likely to be injured in a road traffic accident if you live in a high income country than you are in a low income country. And yet in a high income country, people were very aware of that risk. The perception was much higher. And we think that's because in low-income countries, actually, there are many more present risks. So people are worried about where their next meal is coming from. They're worried about crime and violence. And so it's very interesting.
One of the things, obviously, has upended the world since you all launched this effort and really started thinking about this research now a couple of years ago, is COVID-19 and this global pandemic. How do you get your mind around risk and a pandemic? How are you all thinking about tackling that in your future research and your future work?
I think there are many, many areas of insight that the World Risk Poll has given us that are of relevance to the pandemic. I mean, the fact that we know that demographics influences how people think about risk. And in fact, we see this every day in people's behaviour in response to COVID. We have people who are shielding because they're aware of the fact that they are high risk. We have other people who don't have that risk profile in terms of their medical history, and yet they are very, very concerned about the virus. And we have others who are not. and are not taking the precautions that, that actually, you know, governments are mandating that they should. And so, you know, there is learning here from the World Risk Poll that, that can influence how, you know, how risk is communicated, which I think would be of great relevance for the pandemic. In terms of the future, we'll be following up in the field in 2021. We've just got the results of the cognitive testing back, so we don't know which questions we'll be taking forward, but certainly there will be a COVID focus, and it will probably be around people's resilience and the resilience of their communities to COVID.
Richard, how have you been thinking through COVID as a person who's also thinking about this global project and how to measure risk? How has it changed your thought process, your lens?
In some respects, you know, we've been very fortunate in so much as that we've managed to conduct this poll before COVID struck. So we've got a view of the world that we could never replicate now. We could never go back and reproduce this. We clicked the shutter and we've got a snapshot picture of the perception of risk for the pandemic. And when we repeat this, we can see how mindsets and actuality of change. So that's one point. We also, you know, to go back to our mission space as well, we're here to make the world a safer place. We're interested in critical infrastructure. There are lots of ways in which the critical infrastructure that we all rely on can get stressed. A pandemic is one. And it was probably before this not very high up on our radar, and we thought about other stressors. They could be economic stressors, they could be even, you know, environmental stressors, extreme natural weather hitting the infrastructure that we rely on, high winds or waves or temperatures or whatever, or even things to do like displacement of people for whatever reasons during the world can all start to stress our critical infrastructure. And I think that what COVID is showing us for the first time is that our critical infrastructure is not as resilient as we hoped and believed it was. And when it does get stressed, it is very complex. It's connected in ways we don't really understand, and bits of it don't work or they fall over. So I think that we will start to look at our critical infrastructure with the hindsight of the pandemic in a fresh way. I think as well, one of the things, just to go back to some of the poll data, your questions were asked, and so we've got some evidence and insight into where do people get their trusted information from? People in 25% of the countries that we've polled said that they did not trust their governments to provide information or to deliver their critical infrastructure. And so, you know, this whole thing around risk, it's the perception of it and taking action. Where do people go for their trusted information? And it's not always where you might think.
And it's just anecdotally speaking, at least, is probably the concern about that has only increased, right, since the pandemic. At least, I mean, I sit here in the United States where it's become a very politicized issue. And you know, it is very interesting that something, you know, a public health risk, something you think should be able to just look up a website and see what you should do, gets very complicated. The other thing to just think about with COVID and risk that's really struck me is the different socioeconomic realities we live, right? Like if you can continue to work virtually like we all are, you're living a different reality than somebody that actually needs to go out there and subject themselves to contracting this horrible disease to just make a living. So there's just so much that you all have built as a wonderful launching pad, I think, for the world to learn, just like you said, Richard, what this world was like before and what risk of this new world looks like for us now. I want to thank you both so much for being on the show. Sarah Cumbers is Director of Evidence and Insight at Lloyd's Register Foundation. Richard Clegg is Managing Director at Lloyd's Register Foundation. The study is called the World Risk Poll. I'd encourage you to just Google that and check out the study website, which is beautiful. You can also find it on Gallup.com or, of course, on Lloyd's Register Foundation's own web space. Thank you both for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's our podcast. Thank you for tuning in. To subscribe to the podcast from any podcast app, just search the Gallup Podcast. And for more key findings from Gallup News, go to news.gallup.com or follow us at Gallup News. If you have questions, feedback, or suggestions on topics for future episodes, we want to hear from you. Write to us directly by emailing podcast@gallup.com. This Gallup Podcast is directed by Curtis Grubb and produced by Justin McCarthy. I'm Muhammad Yunus. And this is Gallup, reporting on the will of the people since the 1930s.